Hi there, and welcome to the Curiosity Cast. I'm Karen Ward. Coming right up, my conversation with Charles Green about trust, intimacy, and curiosity. But first, a short story about trust in a foreign land. In 2003, I took 3 months off and went to Turkey to volunteer at a women's co-op in a region called Cappadocia. While I was there, I met an antiques dealer named Crazy Alley. He was the friend of the woman who had started the co-op where I was working and a respected elder in the village. And he had a shop on the main square. And every couple of days, I would drop by for a visit over many cups of tea to chat about village politics, Turkish history, and the meaning of life. One day, Ali waved me into the shop and asked if I'd like to join a small group that he was taking out on a moonlight hike through the Red Valley that evening. I immediately said yes. But as our group of six descended into the shadowy Red Valley that night, miles from the village, in the dark, a thought I'm not proud of crossed my mind. This is how dumb tourists die in foreign lands. And yet, there I was, hiking with this group of strangers through an isolated landscape in the dark with no idea where I was going or what was going to happen. So that adventure into the Red Valley was definitely an exercise in trust for me, which brings us to our focus today, trust. I'm so happy to have Charles Green with us. He is the CEO of Trusted Advisor Associates, the author of several books, and a man with a really important message. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the Curiosity Cast.
Thank you, Karen. My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So to start off, this may sound like a cruel question, but I'm wondering, it seems like trust, you know, to build great relationships, it seems almost obvious or intuitive that trust should be part of that. So on some level, it's incredible to me that you've built this incredible following and business practice for yourself around the concept and the practice of trust when shouldn't we all kind of get that and do it automatically? Like, why do we struggle with this?
Why do we struggle?
Yeah,
it's a great question. And I've come to recognize that the subject matter, while on one level, it is absolutely simple, you know, dirt simple, like you said.
Yeah.
But we confuse ourselves once we start trying to think about it. And most things in business we have learned to subject to analytical rigor and create processes and metrics, and trust doesn't quite submit to that.
Right. And so I'm wondering, you know, you're going into these professional service firms who are credentialing and, you know, trying to be highly, highly objective and quantified in their approach. How do they respond to your message about trust? You know, I think it's really interesting that you're sort of bringing a qualitative concept and practice into a very quantitative environment.
Well, that question gets to the heart of the dynamic. People have to sort of overcome that notion in the first place to even invite me in.
Right.
So they must suspect there's something beyond just, report mechanization or transparency principles or something. And once there, I've become very conscious of exactly that dilemma. How do you sell the subjective, squishy, fog sculpting soft stuff to people who are, you know, pride themselves in being hard-assed and quantitative and so forth?
I can't wait for the answer. Go.
Well, it's a couple of things. One, I make sure that I advertise myself on my credentials. And then the first thing I say to them is a story I tell of myself about what a bumbling fool I was. So what I'm in a particular situation, a selling situation,
right,
how I was so embarrassed and so forth. And so I'm demonstrating, vulnerability, mm-hmm, and sharing something. We'll talk about the notion of intimacy later.
Mm-hmm.
But it also relates to people. Every single person in that audience has been in a situation like I was, where the question basically was, what do you know about such and so? And the truth is, I didn't know anything about it. And what do you do when you get a question like that? Well, if you open up that way, and basically I'm saying, can we be honest here for a minute? This happens, right? What do you do when it happens?
Right.
And the answer, whatever you do, makes an enormous amount of difference as to whether you are trusted or not. And the ability to say, here's what I know, here's what I don't know, it's paradoxical. It turns out that the phrase, I don't know, is about the most trust-creating thing you can say. Nobody's going to doubt you on that line.
Right.
I don't know.
They'll believe you if you say, I don't know.
They'll believe you if you say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And you walk in saying, I am curious about this conversation. I want to know more about this client, about this person sitting across the table from me. I will find some stuff out. I hope I know some things that I can bring to the conversation. I'm sure there'll be some things I don't know about. Let's find out. And whatever the outcome is will probably be the right outcome. Now, we don't do that. Instead, we walk into a conversation like that thinking, oh my gosh, I hope I look good. I hope I'm able to sell. I hope I walk out of here with a second appointment. All of which is totally internal to ourselves about trying to control the other person. So it shows up very quickly in things like listening.
Right.
We've all been across the table from people who are interviewing us or talking to us, and you can see the gears going in their head and their eyes shift off to the side. They're not listening to what we're saying. And we know that immediately in our guts. And so do the other people when we do it. We're not that much better than them.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of authenticity or showing up, it shows up as fast as people can tell whether you're actually paying attention or not. If you're worried about getting the sale, if you're worried about looking smart, then you will not be fully paying attention. And the other person knows it in their bones.
And that impacts trust, obviously.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. Okay, so I want to make sure we talk about the trust equation, because that was a real, when you and I met earlier this year, that was a real, really powerful framework for me that I have shared with some of our clients with really great success. Like, it was a real mind opener for them around the importance of trust. So tell us about that and how it works and how you use it in the coaching and training work that you do with your clients.
Yes. Well, I think it may end up being the thing on my gravestone. You know, the most important thing we came up with was the trust equation.
Right.
Basically, it's a way of looking. Remember, I talked about trusting and being trusted. The best way to be trusted is to be worthy of trust,
right,
to be trustworthy. So the trust equation is a way of unpacking trustworthiness. It's really the trustworthiness equation, I should say. And I suggest to you, there are basically four factors that go into it, which we can define and think about separately. And each of them has an impact on trustworthiness. And those four factors are credibility plus reliability plus intimacy, all of those divided by self-orientation. And very quickly defining them, the three factors in the numerator. Credibility basically is, do I believe what this person is telling me? It's very much about words and belief in your veracity. Second one, reliability, has more to do with your actions. And it's, can I depend on this person? Will they do what they say? Integrity actually falls into this category as well. Those two, credible, reliable, are kind of the hard, rational end of trustworthiness, mm-hmm. which we're all pretty comfortable with.
Sure.
The third variable in the numerator is quite different. It's intimacy. We chose intimacy as a deliberately kind of provocative term just to get people to think about it. What it really means is, do other people feel safe around me? Do they feel comfortable sharing confidences with me? Do they feel that I'm going to treat it appropriately, that I'm going to laugh at the right places and not laugh at the right places,
right,
that I'll be careful whom I pass it along to, all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the denominator, the factor self-orientation has to do with, where's my attention? Who am I paying attention to? Part of that is selfishness. If I'm selfish, if I have a high selfishness score, that's going to lower my trustworthiness score.
Mm-hmm.
But the more normal form of self-orientation is just self-preoccupation, self-obsession, always being worried neurotically about how I'm looking, how I'm sounding, how smart they think I am.
Right. So it's like Captain Narcissist.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you can actually put numbers into that and play with the numbers, scale of 1 to 10 for each of them. And in fact, we did come up with an online survey called the Trust Quotient. 60,000 people have now taken that, and over time, we've been able to put together some profiles of what the results are, what people look like overall, which of those four factors is the most important, which is interesting. I actually thought it was going to be self-orientation, which is why we put it alone in the denominator.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out the biggest, most important factor, drum roll please, is intimacy.
Interesting.
And it's very interesting. And it makes an awful lot of sense,
yeah,
if I can go on for a second.
Absolutely,
here.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of the other findings is, well, let me ask you this one. Who do you think is more trustworthy, men or women? What would you guess?
Well, admitting my gender bias, I'm going to come down on the side of the ladies on this one.
Well, 85% of people do, and 85% of people are right.
Interesting.
Women are statistically meaningfully more trustworthy by this definition of 60,000 people taking it than are men. And almost all the reason for the higher score on the part of women is due to one factor. Want to take a guess what that factor would be?
I'm going to guess it's intimacy.
You would be right.
That's exactly so interesting,
right.
Yeah.
And here's the clincher to my mind. If you think about the most trustworthy professions, most and least, if I ask you what are the least trustworthy professions, we've all seen surveys like this, or you can just answer from your own common sense. Bottom of the list, politicians and lawyers.
That's right.
And they've been down there for some time. Top of the list, people have to think about it. They often think, well, doctors, teachers, pharmacists, clergy, who've been dropping
nurses.
For some reason.
Yeah.
Nurses
yeah.
are number one.
I was going to say nurses.
Are number one.
Yeah.
You are absolutely right.
Yeah.
And if you think about which of those four factors nurses embody, it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. It is intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
We are completely safe in front of nurses. We tell them the truth. We expect them to tell us the truth. And you know, I say we are literally and figuratively naked in front of nurses,
yeah.
and they make it okay.
Yeah.
So this notion of intimacy being the most powerful factor is really, it makes a lot of common sense. And I think that is more valuable than a high R squared on a regression analysis. It just plain makes sense in life.
Yeah. And is that, Charles, is that assessment available for free on your website?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Thank you for the opening to the plug.
Yeah, definitely. Plug away.
TrustedAdvisor.com. On the upper right of that homepage, you will find a place where you can take the free TQ, free trust quotient test. You'll get a one or two page output. It'll tell you your score. It'll tell you your top and your bottom ones. It'll give you a couple other teaser bits of information. If you're really curious about this and you're willing to pay $29 or $30, I forget what it is, you can get the full 20 page output and learn an awful lot about it. But there's good stuff available for free.
As I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about some of the both entrepreneurs that we work with and also the executives that are working in large Fortune, you know, 1 in 500 companies with really large brands. Does the trust equation work when you are a small business, when you are a big brand, and maybe not in the professional services context, but you're thinking about how can we be more trustworthy as a mega brand, whether it's a Google
right.
or a Molson Coors or whoever it is, does the trust equation still apply, or does it really hinge on having more sort of having a business or a brand having more personal, more intimate interaction with its customers?
Well, you put your finger on the right thing at the end there. The trust equation is mainly about personal interactions between human beings. For example, the notion of intimacy is completely alien. It doesn't even make sense to say, General Electric is intimate. Maybe the people whom you interact with at General Electric are intimate
right,
or not.
Right.
And it really doesn't make sense to say that a corporation or a business or even a brand is self-oriented. And only metaphorically is that true. It does make some sense to say that General Electric or NBC or whatever is reliable, dependable. They have a track record. You can measure that.
Uh-huh.
Inanimate objects have a track record. So do dogs.
Right.
And credibility, I guess you could say there's something to that too. Are the financial statements particularly open and transparent, or are they opaque? But for the most part, the trust equation is about people. And when you talk about corporate trustworthiness, do we trust XYZ company?
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a much less strong version of the word. We simply don't trust companies as much, nearly as much as we trust people, because most of the components of the trust equation are missing when you're talking about a third-party entity.
Right.
The things that you can do, there are two things. One, you can maximize, your effectiveness on the credible and reliable component. That does make sense. It does kind of transfer over. Do you do inbound marketing? Do you put a lot of information on the web to help people understand? Do you admit fallibility?
Mm-hmm.
Have you got a great track record and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
But the other big thing that you have to think about when you transfer trust to the organizational level is, do they or do they not operate by a set of principles that encourage a trust-creating environment? You want to have an environment that makes people willing and happy and delighted to be trustworthy and also to trust others. And without going too far off in that, there are four principles that I came up with in my second book that talk about creating organizational trust, and you've heard them all. There's number one, be client-focused or customer-focused for the sake of the customer,
right.
not for your bottom line.
Right, right.
Number two, collaborate with them. You're supposed to be on the same team, not different teams.
Yeah.
Number three, always look at the medium to long term, not the short term, or in other words, focus on relationships, not transactions.
Yeah.
And finally, make transparency the default condition as opposed to only if you're okay with it. So assume you should be open unless it's illegal or hurtful to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And if you religiously apply those four principles to all aspects of corporate life, you will create an environment where people naturally are encouraged to become more trustworthy and also to trust others. And all kinds of good things happen when you do that.
Yeah.
So really, for trust to work, we have to become adept at going back and forth, being vulnerable ourselves. That's part of the risk-taking. Learning to proactively seek out situations of intimacy rather than waiting for our customers and clients to raise them. And so the way trust works is kind of hand over hand, back and forth, climbing the ladder of I trust, you trust, I trust, you trust. And it builds. That is how you build trust, playing it back and forth.
Through reciprocity, so it's not one-sided. Okay, I want to shift gears a little bit. Related topic that I am very passionate about, and it's connected to trust. When we met several months ago, you took the group that what you were speaking to through your top 10 trust list.
Oh, right.
And the very first item on that list was cultivating an attitude of curiosity. And I nearly got up and gave you a standing ovation right on the spot. And it's really a key reason why I wanted to have this conversation, the excellent work that you're doing in trust notwithstanding. But I so rarely hear people in business, thoughtful, interesting, smart, senior people in business, talking about curiosity as it relates to other core concepts in business excellence. And I just was so excited and really want you to say more about why you think curiosity and trust are so intimately linked, and how we do that. How do we cultivate an attitude of curiosity, and how does that help in the context of trust?
Great question, and I'm appreciate that you also obviously put it at the top of your list. So I want to hear a few thoughts from you too, but I'll lead off.
Sure.
If you are able to be curious, it presupposes a couple of things. Number one, it means you've got your own ego under control. You're not constantly freaking out, worried about what other people are thinking of you, what you're going to say next. You are actually at ease enough to have a conversation with another person and actually listening to what they are saying. So number one, if you're curious, it means you're okay with yourself, which is critical. If you're not okay with yourself, it means you're obsessing and you're not focused on the other person.
Right.
It just all falls apart.
Yeah.
The other thing it means, if you're able to be curious, is it means you're willing and able to listen. And you are naturally drawn to asking the kinds of open-ended questions and paying attention. And attention and open questions are the currency of trust and listening. It is what it's inviting the other person to say, you know what, this is your agenda, your time frame. I am interested in what you have to say. Tell me more. You set the agenda. You set the priorities. That's what you're saying when you're acting in a state of curiosity. I guess another thing it means is you rarely go into conversations without having done a little bit of homework to figure out what you think might be the issues so that you can be a full participant in that conversation rather than simply an empty sponge flailing around in the moment.
Right.
So you'll come up with some questions ahead of time that you'd be interested in hearing the answers to. And I suggest to people keep a list of 20 questions for each of your several key client persons.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you meet with them, pull one question off the top of the deck and ask them and have a conversation. And later on, go back and add another one at the bottom of the deck. Because if you do that, you're lowering your self-orientation, which fits in the trust equation.
Yes.
You are listening, which we didn't talk about the model of creating trust, but fast forward, it's about listening to pay attention to the other person.
Yeah.
And it triggers this whole notion of reciprocal and respect. To actually pay attention to another human being is the highest compliment you can pay them. And it naturally triggers this reciprocal response in us as human beings. Wow, you were gracious to me. Thank you. Now I will listen to you. So the power of reciprocity here, I'm not the first one to point it out, is if you listen to me, I will listen to you. And it's remarkable in how many professions we can see that reciprocal dynamic, from suicide hotlines to really great lawyers to sales books are written on it. All this stuff is the power of really, truly listening. And that is all triggered by being curious. So lots of reason to put curiosity at the top of the list there.
So again, this seems really obvious to me. It's part of the reason I built a whole business around the concept of curiosity, and we're starting to, you know, develop a lot more content and coaching and, you know, courses actually teaching around different aspects of curiosity. I'm wondering why it feels difficult for people. Like, it feels almost, it's linked to trust,
right?
Not surprisingly. It's like trust seems pretty obvious. Being curious and getting outside of your own self-interest to explore the world and what others think and care about, that seems kind of obvious. Like, why in business in particular do we struggle with curiosity? Why does it feel hard in professional contexts?
I think the reason it is difficult and we don't see it that often comes down to two things. Number one, to be curious and to trust and be in a trust relationship, you have to be emotionally mature. You have to be a person who is, pick whatever model you want, you know, emotionally well-developed, secure, comfortable with yourself. I'm forgetting the other buzzwords for it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because until you're there, you can't really pay attention to another human being, which means you are completely wrapped up in yourself. The other reason is that it's another hobby horse of mine. In the last five decades or so in business, we have gone extremely in the direction of an unfortunate model, sort of rational self-maximization, Hobbesian world of everybody's evil out there and Darwinian struggle,
right.
Nasty, brutish, and short. And we've bought into that the purpose of a corporation is to make profit. The very definition of strategy, which evolved in the late 70s with BCG and Michael Porter, became competitive strategy. Mm-hmm. How do you attain sustainable competitive advantage over your competitors? All of that is about beating the other guy.
Right.
And it doesn't matter whether the other guy is a competitor in your business or your customer or your supplier. We've all been raised in business with the attitude that the purpose is to win. So there's my two reasons. You have to be mature emotionally, and you have to transcend the sort of language of business that's very zero-sum driven that we've developed over the past five decades.
And why does curiosity fight against that? Like, why can't, well, let's assume we think that sort of framework is the right one, the sort of kill or be killed idea. Why does curiosity not fit into that archetype or that framework?
If you buy into the kill or be killed mentality, then the only reason to be curious is to find out in which ways those persons might harm me or in which ways I might harm them.
Right.
And I don't particularly care about themselves. You know, who gives a damn?
Yeah.
What's in it for me?
Right.
Whereas if you had a relationship trust-driven mentality, you might treat all these interactions as chances to create a little more trust, a little more brand image, a little more positive future long-term relationships by being nice to people.
Mm-hmm.
Or by maybe occasionally helping them out a little bit, taking a minute out of your time to help them find another solution if they came to you wrongly, rather than just get them out of the way. And those benefits do pay off economically. We didn't even talk about the power of trust, but it is not this Beatles song Buddhist thing. It's absolutely bottom line profit model, business school. It works.
Right.
It works better than the competitive zero-sum model.
Yeah. Hooray! I want to stand up and give you another standing O for that one. So I love that. I mean, I think in the work that we do, we talk a lot about, you know, different C's that are connected to curiosity. So for me, one of them is courage. Another one is confidence. So that very much ties into this notion of being self-aware and emotionally mature and, you know, grounded in yourself first, because I think it's from that place of confidence and courage, which is about having the courage to be vulnerable and say, gosh, what a brilliant question. I have no idea. I'll go find out, or let's explore that together. Or is that, you know, worth spending time on? And then the other C that we talk a lot about also as it relates to curiosity is collaboration. And I think in this notion, this framework, you know, past 50 years, business education execution framework of kill or be killed, there's not a lot of collaboration that takes place in that model, even within organizations, I think, as they're trying to figure out how to, you know, assess threats and opportunities and with, you know, collaboration, and not at all costs, because sometimes we do need to, you know, have our own brain and think for ourselves and then come back and contribute. But without some of those other C's around curiosity, it makes working and living with curiosity, which we think about as a mindset, a skill set, and a set of behaviors, it does make it challenging. So when we're working in organizations and we see sort of a lack of curiosity, or they just, you know, crush it willingly, knowingly or not, sometimes I start thinking about and picking around, it's like, well, how much confidence are people allowed to exhibit here? Or is the source of confidence, does it live somewhere else in the organization, not within individuals? Right. Is courage rewarded or punished? How much collaboration is present? And so anyway, these are the things that, you know, I'm starting to get really excited about as we're having conversations with you know, clients and others about how we make curiosity more palpable for them. Like, everybody understands what curiosity is, but it's hard for people to understand why it matters in business.
Things work better if we deal with people as authentically full human beings. So get rid of the short-term mentality, get rid of the mechanical robot automaton mentality, and role model long-term and human interactive. Then you will see some change towards trust in an organization.
And what curiosity, you know, you've talked about habits and behaviors and practices. What are some of the curiosity habits or practices that you have that keep you sharp in terms of cultivating an attitude of curiosity and expressing that in a really deep and meaningful way in your work? Are there any like tricks and tips or habits that you have in your life that you could share?
Yeah, there are. And it's important to say what they are. What's behind that is a great line. What's behind that, as opposed to what? Are you kidding me? How could you possibly? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Discipline yourself to say, gee, what's behind that? Tell me more, I've learned to say, as opposed to another closed-end question driving towards what I want.
I love that. Okay, here's my last question for you. It's a fill in the blank. We like to wrap up this one all the time.
Okay.
So fill in the blank. A world without curiosity is or would be what in your mind?
Wow. Boring, unbelievably boring. Dull, uninspired. Obviously self-oriented, inward-looking, very unfriendly, cloudy. I just picture people walking around stewing in their own juices and not having any interactions to speak of, because curiosity is what makes us reach out to other people with genuineness. And so a world without curiosity, that to me is a world without genuine interest in anybody else. And what a terrible world to live in.
Gross. We don't want that world. I agree.
We do not want that world.
Now, would you add a world without curiosity is unprofitable if we make the world the business world?
Yes, I would actually.
So like a business world without curiosity would be what for you?
Well, it's suboptimal. I mean, let's think of it in economic terms. The truth is, if you have a series of trusted relationships which are founded on being concerned and interested in the needs and wants of others, that synergies do happen. Things happen more quickly. You look at that book by Stephen M. R. Covey Jr., The Speed of Trust. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely right. When there trust exists, when you have a culture, an attitude, a behavior, a bunch of people of trust, things go faster, number one. Speed is profitable. Number two, things cost less. Cost less is also profitable. Faster, lower cost. Wow, is that not a recipe for the bottom line?
Right.
Totally it is. There's also innovation in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it all does start with curiosity. You have to genuinely be interested in the other person, not just what they can do for you.
So Charles, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I have loved this interesting, engaging, provocative, curious, trusting, and trustworthy conversation so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity and the format too. You've done a great job with this.
So obviously, I didn't meet with a terrible end during that moonlit hike in Turkey so many years ago. But as I reflect on that experience in the context of my conversation with Charles, I realized that I said yes to that hike because I trusted Crazy Alley. Sure, I was curious and I definitely didn't want to miss out on such a unique experience, but ultimately, it came down to trust. Crazy Alley ticked all of the boxes on the trust equation. My trust for him was based on credibility and reliability because he was a friend of someone I knew and he always did what he said he would. My trust for him was based on intimacy because I had spent hours in conversation with him at his shop. And it was also based on his utter lack of self-orientation. He was incredibly generous and was always thinking about what I should do and see and who I should meet so I could get the most out of my experience in Turkey. So as we wrap up today's episode, I want to ask you how you're showing up in your work and relationships with others. Is it with intimacy or ego? And how are you activating your curiosity superpowers to become more trustworthy? What would shift for you if you entered conversations and relationships with questions and interest instead of knowledge and certainty? I'd love to hear your thoughts and would welcome any experiences that you'd like to share. If you'd like more information about Charles Green and other helpful resources related to trust and curiosity, please come over and visit us at curiosityinc.com, and you can also follow us on Twitter at CuriosityChat. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay curious. I'm Karen Ward.